This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim.
This week on the show, the world is not like us, but you all are. So you'll get your PU, your WQ, and your MiFi, and David Poe casts Matt Damon as Sergey Brin. All this on This Week in Media, episode 135. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I am your host, Daisy Whitney, of the New Media Minute and of This Week in Media. So I'm glad to be back. Some of you are watching us live on This Week in Technology Network. So thank you for those of us who are joining us live. Those of you who will be listening later on in the week, we, as always, appreciate your listenership. And we have a fun episode today. I'm very excited because we have a special guest. David Pogue from the New York Times is joining us. David, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here. So I don't think I have to really introduce David. Most of you who listen to this show know him and adore him and are among his 277,000 plus Twitter followers and many, many more readers. So, but he pretty much knows everything about technology. So there you go. And you have to live up to it, David. And as always, Alex Lindsay is co-hosting. Hello, Alex.
Hello. How's it going?
Alex is head of Pixel Core.
That's me.
And before we get to the news, let's pay some bills.
We would like to thank, of course, this show is sponsored by Audible.com, my favorite place to buy books. I think a lot of people think of going to a bookstore to buy books. And I don't really, that would require reading, which is not something that I do as much. I read the New York Times and I read The Economist and then I listen to everything else. So that's pretty much my little world. So Audible is one of my favorite places.
And the place you want to go is audiblepodcast.com/twim. And as always, we like to recommend a book. So, and as you know, I am an avid reader and I am a huge, huge fan of Evermore, which is by Allison Noel and is a New York Times bestseller. Number one. It's been number one in the paperback children's list. It's a young adult novel. It's been number one for about 10 weeks. So it's also a great listen. And the next book in her series, Blue Moon, is due to come out this summer. So it's basically, if you're not familiar with Evermore, it's kind of it's like Twilight, but a little bit more mature, a little bit more clever, kind of a step above, very, very creative. And I know a lot of girls who like it and a lot of boys who like it. So that's my recommendation for today.
Excellent.
Anything else we need to say about Audible? Are we good?
I think we're good.
Okay, so
the one thing is where people can go if they are listening to this show and they want to get a free copy of their free Audible is they can go to audiblepodcast.com/twim. I think in the past we've said audible.com/twim. It is not correct. It is audiblepodcast.com/twim. And in addition to getting a free book, it makes us look cool. So you want to go over there.
We want to look cool. Yeah. Speaking of looking cool, the three of us have all seen Star Trek because we would have big L's if we came in here for the show and hadn't seen Star Trek. Okay, guys, what did you think of it? David, since you're our guest, we'll start with you. Guest first. What did you think of the new Star Trek?
Well, you know, I saw it on IMAX, so, you know, not the same experience you little people had.
Now, I got a question for you about the IMAX, because I want to go see it again in IMAX. Leo and I saw it at a regular theater over the weekend, and now I'm going to go see an IMAX. Do you think the IMAX quality lives up to going to see it on IMAX?
Yes, this is one that you should see in IMAX. And the IMAX that shows these big movies where I live in Connecticut is an hour away. So it's a big effort to go see them, and not all of them have been worth it. But this one, my friends, was worth it.
Okay, so what was there any scene in particular that stood out where you thought, oh, this was worth the hour-long drive each way? This was worth the trek for new trek?
You know, I'd say, well, first of all, of course, the space and planetary scenes where it's about the vista. You know, you're literally looking around you. And also, interestingly, all the scenes on the bridge, which are some of the best in the whole movie, just the regular, you know, Enterprise shots, you feel like you're in the room with them. And it's really, really effective.
Okay, so favorite parts of the movie. David, what did you like so much about it?
You know, the whole beginning, the first 20 minutes was just filmmaking at its best. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Onion parody of a breaking news, Star Trek fans bitterly disappointed by the fact that the movie is entertaining and filled with action.
That's
and they have
great.
All these interviews with people outside the theater dressed in, you know, dorky Star Trek costumes saying, I don't get it. Where are the overweight, out of shape people in rubber costumes having fights in slow motion? Where was the stilted dialogue? You know, what is this action humor? I don't get it. J.J. Abrams just had the most difficult task in the world to come up with a movie that the fans, the cultists, would not snipe at and yet would be broad enough and appeal to everybody. It's a really hard line to walk, a fine line to walk. And he did it. I mean, he just – the movie flies. There are no giant glaring potholes.
He also set up the whole franchise again. I mean, he basically redefined the entire – structure so that you are able to now do anything you want in the Star Wars universe and it would be quote unquote legal.
Yeah, that's right. Because he, I don't want to give the spoiler away, but the way they set up the P period, U period, means that he can do anything he wants from now on.
Now, one thing that I found interesting, and this is coming from my perspective, I'm not, as most of our listeners know, I'm not sort of the hardcore Star Trek or Star Wars or sci-fi fan, so I think I look at it through a slightly different prism. I thought it was really interesting and kind of clever that the main emotional arc and storyline in this movie had to do with Spock and not with Kirk. You sort of expect that it would be Kirk and, you know, kind of his father and all that and stepping into what it means to be captain of the Starship Enterprise. But it was really interesting that ultimately the main storyline was Spock and how he kind of deals with the emotions, bless you, Colleen, that come his way. So I thought that was, you know, sort of an unexpected twist. And, you know, maybe that's just the female in me talking. So there you go.
All right. But it did well. I think it's the best, by far, the best opening for a Star Trek opening. I think the last best of was 30 million. So it's,
wow.
I think
and this did 72.5 million, I believe. Now, speaking of other movies that opened well, of course, the previous week, Wolverine had a very good opening and earned 85 million at the box office. But interestingly, last week, there were some reports about just how widespread the pirating was for Wolverine. And as we've talked about on this show, and certainly has been reported pretty extensively in the media, there was a pirated version of the film released about a month beforehand online. And now Fox is saying that pirated version was downloaded more than 4 million times, which if you add up potential box office receipts, that would have been 28.7 million.
Okay, do we really think that they lost that much money?
I don't think they lost 28.7 million because not all of those, you know, some of those people are watching it a couple of times. Some are people who are just diehards and are going to see it in both places. But right. who knows how much they lost? But I guess the question is, you know, at what price is piracy these days? And is that one of the most extensive cases or ramifications of piracy that might potentially...
Well, all I got to say is I did not download it, but I did have the luxury of seeing it. And someone else that I knew showed it to me, and it was...
oh, wait, so you watched the pirated version,
but
you didn't enjoy it yourself, so that's okay?
Yeah, exactly. That's as far as I'm concerned.
And I didn't inhale.
I didn't inhale. So the... I mostly... I'm too paranoid. You know, I'm in this industry, so I'm too paranoid to download anything. So I just stay away. You know, I kind of try to keep my fingers clean.
It's a good idea to respect copyright.
But but I watched it, and I have to admit, they should put that on the DVD. It is it's just great to see a movie half done. I mean, I think that there's something about it. Like, you still see the cables, and you still see the, the animatics for some of the shots, and you still see, like, and that's what I, you know, working in films, that's what I see all the time. And it's a great little, like, really show you how much gets done in some of these movies. I thought it was actually something that would get people more interested in seeing the final movie. I don't think anyone would watch that film, watch the one that leaked, and feel like they had the same experience as going to the theater.
So you don't think... So Fox didn't lose $28.7 million in your view that was just folks who were going to do that were going to do that, and probably many of those are also... theater goers.
I think it's likely they didn't lose. I think it probably is almost a wash.
David, your hand is up.
Yes,
thoughts
you
on piracy.
Not to take this off topic, but this interesting question of piracy versus ticket sales. I got into a little flack with my readership last year over my objection to seeing unprotected PDFs of my books floating around online, and they were on all kinds of piracy sites, and I bemoan the fact that this is my kids' college tuition being frittered away. And my readers really were not satisfied with that logic. And they said, dude, for all you know, every time someone sees a pirated copy, it introduces them to your work and your style, and they'll go out and buy 3 of the real books. And I said, that's baloney. And then they said, you will never really know unless there's some kind of parallel universe, or PU, where I do and I do not release the same book as a PDF. So somebody challenged me, take one of your books, just one of your books, release it as an unprotected PDF, and track the sales over the year before and tell us whether or not it boosts sales. And I said, I know how this is going to turn out. It's going to be pirated all over the net. This is nuts. But okay. So I took the only book I had that would be in existence longer than a year, because they're computer books, which was my Windows Vista, The Missing Manual. And O'Reilly offered that as an unprotected PDF for sale. And sure enough, I was right. It's a massively pirated book. It's all over everywhere's site. It's easy to find, totally ripping me off. And yet, the readers were also right that year over year, with all other factors eliminated, book sales of that book were better.
Wow.
So both sides were right. The exposure helped, and it was pirated like mad. So the net result for the release of the Wolverine movie is, I'll bet you they did not lose $28 million. I'll bet you the sales figure builds in the interest that was accumulated by people looking at the pirate version.
What's interesting, that's kind of what Mark Cuban, who has sort of been not a proponent of piracy, but he has been a proponent of not wasting, from a media company's perspective or even from an individual's perspective, not wasting your time fighting piracy. That there's the idea that it exists, and to some degree it can help build an audience. Well, and that's obviously what you experienced, David, when you allowed it to be pirated, is yes, it was, but the upshot was still good.
Right. That's right.
What do you guys think about the Gigantor Kindle?
David?
I'm going to start. Yeah, David, what do you think? I mean, first of all, for everyone who doesn't yet know the price, $489. The screen is 2.5 times the size of the other Kindle, the one that came out in February and the prior one. And it's supposed to be, I got to tell you, what I think is funny is this is supposed to be for newspapers. I mean, the newspapers are struggling more than any other medium right now. So does anybody think people are going to go spend $500 to read newspapers when they don't even want to read them right now, when they aren't really showing any signs that they have a lot of interest in reading them in other venues? Okay, that's just my opinion. What do you guys think?
No, I think that that's not the case. I think the readership of newspapers is actually up. It's readership of the newspaper that's collapsing. But I mean, millions and millions of people read them online. The world still needs, and I believe will always still demand, a news gathering operation. You know, it's not going to just be bloggers reporting about, you know, stains on Bill Clinton's dress, or I didn't get that quite right. But anyway, so there will always need to be a New York Times, a Wall Street Journal, someone to ask the questions. But, you know, whether it's going to come on printed paper, I'm not sure. I mean, the website stuff is way up. And some people are even suggesting that by the time the New York Times does the math, they could give every subscriber a free Kindle and still make more money than they would had they continued selling newspaper subscriptions. In other words, you buy us your subscription, you get the Kindle for free. Someone actually did the math online. That's kind of interesting.
Well, it would be great if a media company actually tried that experiment. I mean, that would be a very daring experiment. I think we've mentioned it in a couple months ago, and I don't know that anybody would actually have the cojones to do that. But wouldn't that be cool if we actually saw a media company like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or someone actually say, you know what?
Well, we are
just going all out and trying a radically new business model and see if it works.
Well, I think that the return of that is that you could have a bunch of papers get together and create something and create a less
better
expensive
idea.
Kindle. So it's a weird thing. It almost be like having a bunch of cell companies get together, but and give you your iPhone and you could pick whatever you want. But I mean, the point is that all these companies would save money. So if you had Chicago Sun-Times, the New York Times, Boston Globe, all of them putting, you know, doing something that would offset that cost. Now, that's an insane idea that will never happen. But
you know, I don't know that it would never happen. I mean, think about Canoe Ventures, which is, I mean, okay, that might not be the best example because it hasn't really gotten off the ground in a meaningful way. But at the same time, you have all of the major cable operators coming together to try to create a footprint, a national footprint for targeted ads and addressable ads across the United States. It hasn't rolled out yet to a meaningful degree. But at the same time, I think we're seeing more and more examples of companies that were competitors or that might not be direct competitors but are still in the same field of realizing that they have to band together increasingly. I guess one of the questions I have about the Kindle, though, is, you know, having the manageable version, which fits in my purse, which I can carry easily if I don't have my purse, which I can read at a coffee shop or whatever, and then suddenly having to switch to this, you know, gigantic laptop size version. I mean, what's the point? To me, it's too big. It's like a
clipboard. It's 8.5 by 11, and it's got a 9 by 7 screen or something. So you think of these kids lugging 90 pounds of textbooks in their backpacks. It's a no-brainer.
So do you think it will take off then in the college market, David?
If they've got most of the big publishers, textbook publishers on board, if they can keep that up and all the books you want are available for this thing, oh yeah.
All right, so there's life for the Gigantor Kindle. I want to go back to a couple of piracy things because there's been a lot of piracy issues in the news recently. I think this is sort of amusing. The MPAA, which is the Motion Picture... What is it? Motion Picture
Association of America.
That's it, yeah.
I was going to say something that wasn't so nice.
Yeah, this is something I probably shouldn't say on internet radio. Suggest that classrooms videotape flat screens rather than let teachers rip DVDs for classroom use. This was an item in Engadget. The Copyright Office is essentially considering the legality of ripping. And in the midst of that decision-making or whatever it is, the MPAA comes out and says, well, rather than rip them, because that would be piracy and illegal, let's have teachers videotape flat screens of the DVDs and show that.
So...
if you could, so, those of you who are listening, I wish you could see the looks on my guys' faces right now.
Here's the deal: is that I understand the logic. The logic is do not allow a slippery slope. Do not say sometimes it's okay and sometimes it's not okay. All these things. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but I think that more than anything, this just shows how insane the law is right now. So more than, you know, I understand where they're coming from related to this, but I think that it's really showing up. This is just starting to go over the brink.
Well, so how long does the MPAA hang on with this kind of silliness, David?
I don't know. I hadn't heard this one. I must admit, I can't believe it's not more nuanced than that, because that's like stamping, you know, brain dead across their foreheads or something.
It would
almost be like a recording industry association suing individual customers for downloading. I mean, you know, no one would do that. Yeah, the world works in strange and interesting ways, doesn't it?
Well, when the Pirates Bay decision came out about 3 weeks ago, of course, the MPAA issued a statement applauding it and so on. And now that case seems to have some complications all of its own making related to the judge. But I just, you know, I don't think that... I was laughing. I didn't see how anybody in big media could actually applaud the Pirates Bay decision, at least initially, on its own merits, and say this is a good thing, because again, it's a whole slippery slope. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle, the cat's out of the bag, so on and so forth. So I don't know, there seems to be a lot of silliness. But now Sweden, of course, is where the Pirates Bay company website Pirates are based.
Evidently, that's the dock. That's the dock where all the pirates are.
There. Who wants to make the pirate sound?
There's a whole bay.
Who wants? Okay. All right, there you go. All right, you got to make the pirate sound. Now, did you guys know that Sweden is forming a Swedish pirate party, a political party? This is slightly askew, but kind of related to media. Not necessarily new, but it's the first I've heard of it. I thought it was interesting. It's founded by copyright activists in early 2006. The Pirate Party believes people should be able to freely copy books or music for private use. The party is dedicated to radical reform of copyright law, abolition of the patent system, and guaranteed online privacy rights.
And here's the thing.
Isn't that great?
It is great, but for this kind of thing, I believe that it's a very inefficient. Because they'll get, you know, two crazy people in office, and they won't have any leverage, and they'll spend a lot of money and effort trying to move things down. I think that when you're radical, you're better off doing radical things than you are trying to fit inside that larger system. But we'll see how that turns out.
All right. So much for the pirate party in Sweden. Other international stuff. Hulu agrees to international TV deals. So Hulu signed its first international deals last week. I actually got this from the Financial Times. So the story mentioned UK programming coming to the site via agreements with Endemol and others such as Savin. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a Bollywood distributor. Now, this is going to be the first time that some of these shows, international shows, will be seen by a U.S. audience, which is interesting. But we have many international listeners for this show, love to point out that they still can't see what's on Hulu. It's all well and good that those of us here in the U.S. are finally able to see the international programming we've been clamoring for. But it doesn't, from where I sit, it doesn't solve the other problem of the geo-blocking and the other restrictions on the site and all our international friends being able to watch shows. I don't know. What do you guys think about the deal?
I was Twittered and told that I had ruined everything for people. I made a big deal about the fact that Hotspot, works. Hotspot Shield was very effective in Japan to watch Hulu.
Oh no! You ruined it.
It's no longer available.
Are you serious?
You want to tell your friends that the back door is open, but eventually, if you tell enough friends and they tell their friends, then someone realizes the back door is open and they shut it. So
did Hotspot Shield shut?
Well, Hotspot Shield's still around. They just figured out how to
Hulu
tie
did.
Up that. Hulu figured out how to tie that
really?
Loop up. So I don't think it was me. I think it was just someone.
Oh,
finally
it was you.
Looked up. No,
it was you, Alex.
But anyway, so
everybody knew that came from you. David, what's your take on this? I mean, this is something we have. Like I said, we have a lot of international listeners for this show, and we talk about Hulu a lot because obviously it's a big deal here in the U.S. But a lot of folks are frustrated with geo-blocking. Well, and not just on Hulu. I mean, it occurred NBC geo-blocked with Gemini Division over the summer and so on. And I get that there are business reasons, but what's your take on all of that?
I've always been baffled by this. It's proof that human beings are just such a screwed up, hopeless species. I mean, who goes to the trouble of putting together a television show and then not wanting it to be seen by the largest number of viewers possible? Isn't that the point? I mean, I keep running up against these things like I'll do a computer book and I'll have some moron editor say, but you're going to need to get signed permissions for use of the screenshots of the websites featured in the book. What? People kill for viewership. That's why people put up websites. And I don't understand it. Somewhere along the line, common sense has gotten perverted. We create these, like The Amazing Race. Why is The Amazing Race not available online? Not to buy, not to download legally, not any official way. Why? The advertisers would like their ads to be seen? No. The people who created the show would like their show to be seen? No. So who is it? There's some idiot with a law degree in between us and common sense. Why doesn't Hulu want to become the world's leading, station for online TV? I mean, well, obviously they do, but there's some idiots inserting themselves in the process. It makes no sense.
Well, and here's the thing with Hulu. Hulu is, for all intents and purposes, kind of castrated by its ownership. I mean, there's very little that Hulu can actually do on its own. I mean, it's got all of these. First of all, it has its corporate ownership, NBC, Fox, and now Disney. But then it has all of the content owners that it's beholden to. So Hulu can make very few. I mean, Hulu wants to be, obviously, this destination for everything, all premium content that you could see online. That would be great. But I think there's very little change that Hulu can actually affect on its own. I think that's what we learn with Boxy. That's what we're learning with these type of deals, that Hulu can't really think for itself in a lot of cases. It can only think based on what 20th Century Fox or Endemol or Sony says it can do with content. And I think part of the problem is those folks, and I'm not justifying it or defending it, but they all have these international licensing deals where they license a show country by country by country and it rolls out 6 months later or 3 months later, or they sell the rights for it to be formatted in Japan so they do a Japanese version of an American show or whatever, and then the upshot is it gets restricted.
Well, I think that the same approach that says we lost $26 million because of Wolverine, because people downloaded it or whatever. The same approach is the same math that stops a lot of this, because they say that we're making a lot of money, and even though we don't have a distribution deal internationally, we could have a distribution internationally. And if we make this available, then we can't have it. But they don't have it right now. they don't have an exclusive one. And a lot of times these shows go, excuse me, these shows go in and out of being interesting long before anyone finds any way to get them out to the rest of the public. And that's the thing that, and most tech-savvy folks don't care anymore because they've done this for so long that most people have found other ways to get the content.
Well, and you take somebody like Felicia Day with the Guild, where when she did her business deal with Microsoft and Sprint, where she got her official sponsorship and she has distribution on the Xbox and MSN and so on, it was very important to her that it be released worldwide. At the same time, because she has a big international audience for her show. And she even had subtitling, I think, in 8 different countries for it. I mean, when we had iJustine on the show a couple months ago, she had talked about subtitling her videos. And that's something you've been looking into, maybe doing now, Alex. But it was interesting to kind of see. She has a very forward-thinking idea. She's, well, why shouldn't it be released at the same time all around the world?
We have been going in and out of conversations with some cable networks about MacBreak, about we're changing a bunch of stuff internally and whether we could get it into, you know, into a cable network. And the funny thing is that they want exclusive rights, you know, exclusive U.S. rights is what the, you know, and which means not on the internet. I said, I don't think you understand that my viewership is bigger online than it would be on your channel. So, yeah, that's not really.
That's not going to happen. And is that a deal breaker for them, do you think, Alex?
It has been so far.
It's interesting.
But it's not, you know, we're fine with that because it's, as I said, we'd love to do that, but we're not going to take it off the internet, you know, and make it available. And MacBreak, for instance, is Creative Commons. You know, we don't want you to remix it, don't want you to sell it. And when attribution. So it's the most restrictive Creative Commons, but we're basically saying if you want to put it out there anywhere you want, I mean,
put
that's
it on
fine.
A site.
You
know? But how is that any different than just embedding it?
It's similar, except embedding it would be actually sending people to, they're coming to our server. We're saying, okay, you can download it. If you're giving away discs, you could download MacBreak and put it on the disc and give it to people. I mean, exactly what David was talking about is we just want as many people to see it as possible.
And of course, if you were on a cable channel, you would reach a whole new audience.
Yeah, which we're excited about, but we're not willing to give up what we have, you know.
Should you? Side note on Hulu. Now, we've been talking recently about how the site is full of PSAs, public service announcements. And David, we have one. Was Brian Stelter on just last week? I think he was. Yeah, we had your colleague. Brian Stelter comes on the show from time to time. So he was on last week. And one of the topics we talked about was just the abundance of public service announcements on Hulu. And I actually was talking with, I'm not going to name who because you got to protect sources, was talking to a media executive about that recently. And he said, well, one of the things that's going on, yeah, you're going to see a lot of PSAs right now. He said, but the site added so many content partners recently that inventory grew by about 4 times. So ad sales hasn't been able to kind of keep up with that it might have been possible to sell out, because Hulu made a big to-do earlier in the year or late last year about selling out and everything, selling out its inventory. Wow, that's great. What a great spot to be in, especially in this economy and for a new site and so on. Now it's clearly not sold out, but you know what I'm told is that's partly a result of just having so much more inventory, maybe 3 or 4 times. Who knows? Maybe that's just a great excuse. Does that hold water? David, what do you think?
I think so. I think that's plausible. I mean, they got a lot of shows to stick ads in, and each one's a separate deal, right?
Yes, that's true. So maybe that's in defense of Hulu.
I'm past Hulu.
You're over it?
I'm over it.
Where are you watching? So, you were in love with Hulu.
I was.
Hulu is like your new puppy.
I was back when my wife and I couldn't agree on whether we were going to have an LCD or a projector. So we had a laptop that we sat around looking at all the time. So when I was on the web and I was on a laptop, it was fine. It was fine to watch Hulu. It was really cool. And we sat there and watched it. And then I got a big LCD TV. And then my wife got Comcast and I got a Roku and an Apple TV. And so between an Apple TV, a Roku, and you know, there's a little bit of a complication of switching between the two that I had to kind of train everybody in. But between all of those things, I just kind of like, if I can't, this gets back into the argument, if I can't hook it to my TV, not so interested.
So you're watching, unless you're traveling or commuting, and we know you watch videos on your iPhone then.
Pretty much, yeah.
If you're home, you're pretty much watching videos on the TV set.
Yeah. So I'm watching them on the TV set. I got the Roku last week for my wife, and she went crazy. And then I realized...
For the Netflix or for...
Netflix and be able to rent, you know, but just having one box that she could kind of work through. But mostly, I mean, she can rent from the Apple TV as well. But being able to do the Netflix, having just unlimited, not unlimited, but a lot of movies that she can kind of click through and watch. And then I decided I want one for my gym, my little gym area. And but she's not going to give me. She won't. I was just testing the Roku on hers, and now she won't give it back. So now,
yeah,
I
it's sort of like
one.
My husband thinks he should be able to use my Kindle. I'm like, dude, of course, his deal early on was, well, we'll split the price. Whatever. You're not my roommate. You're my husband. Okay. And whatever. Yeah. I paid for it. And then second of all, no, it's mine. I let him read the New York Times on it every day.
Right.
But other than that, I go, no, this is my book. This is where I read books. You order something from audiblepodcast.com.
And I think this gets back into something that we were talking about before the show, actually, is the this idea. Colleen, we were all talking about this here, is this idea that the pipes, you know, like what I like about, like, for instance, the Roku is that I can be in, I can be in anywhere in the house, and I just simply need to have a wireless connection, and I can hook it up. I don't have to figure out whether it's going to be legal for me to put another TV hooked up to it or another. I'm like really getting really past cable as well. Like cable TV, you know, I only watch one show. I just watch Good
what
Eats.
Is it now? Is it The Unit?
Good Eats.
Good Eats.
I downloaded The Unit.
Okay. Now, so David, what do you like to watch? What TV shows do you watch? What web shows do you watch? And how do you watch them?
Watch 60 Minutes and The Amazing Race. And that's really the only routine stuff we do. The kids have their own stuff. What I find is it's all on the TiVo. I've had a TiVo since the very beginning. We've forgotten what ads look like. And the hilarious thing was our four-year-old once was watching a show on his own, and I was walking by the couch as an ad block came on, so I helpfully grabbed the remote and skipped him, and he's like, no, I like that funny part!
They like learning about new things. Kids love ads.
No, my son...
Ads are novelty. Ads are cool. I completely missed that aspect.
My son, no matter what he's doing, he's 17 months old, and no matter what he's doing, when the ads come on, he just stops and turns his head like a little robot and just watches, just sits there. It's like, and he's just like totally transfixed with this, whatever's going on. Like, there's so many synapses going on in his head that his body has stopped moving. Like, and he's sitting there, which is why, of course, I don't want him to see any, like, Frosted Flakes ads or any of that stuff, because I was just
we entered some kind of new age, like a post-neo retro ad age where all of a sudden we're going to buy gadgets that let us watch the ads.
Right. Well, I think that
for them it's news. For them, that's how they learn about new stuff, though. It's really funny.
Yeah, no, I think that for him it's big heads and lots of music, loud music. Mm-hmm. Like that's what's attracting him. I mean, the only other show that he'll actually watch with any regularity is actually Alton Brown's Good Eats. He'll sit there and watch the whole, my wife won't believe it, but he sits there, he'll just sit down and watch it. And it's because there's a lot
wives
of
wives don't believe a lot of things husbands tell them. Alex, don't take it personally.
I just sit there, he'll just lay down and have his bottle and watch Good Eats. And I think the reason is because there's a lot of big head, you know, there's someone talking to you.
That's true. He does look at the camera. Well, that. David, what do you watch? Any online shows that you watch, or whether it's a web show, or are there just watching news videos or The Onion videos, or what are you watching on the web?
Yeah, nothing too regularly. I have to say, I probably create more web video than I consume at this point. But when you have a contract to do one every single week, it's doesn't leave a lot of spare time. But yeah, I love the Onion stuff. Actually, I'm watching a lot of those on the TiVo now too. I've subscribed to a bunch of the New York Times videos. I've subscribed to the Onion. And then beyond that, it's just what people send me as links. I had a run-in with my Twitter followers a couple nights ago, as you well know, Daisy. I admitted on Twitter that I had never run into the term rickrolling.
This is a great story. Yes, tell the story behind this. This is great.
Oh my God! Well, the Twitter people are like, you don't deserve to write for the New York Times. You're a poser. You know, like, what are you, 100 years old? You know, it's just like completely vicious. And by the way, in all the times I've told this story in the days since, not a single normal person knew what rickrolling was either. So it's only like under 30, people with no life. But anyway, so I'm writing this book called The World According to Twitter, where every day I ask a question to my 280,000 followers, like, what's your greatest regret, or what's your best cure for hiccups, or what's the best advice your mother ever gave you? And they respond with these amazingly funny, interesting, hilarious responses. So that night I asked, what are the internet concept and videos that everyone should have seen to be qualified as not, you know, an idiot? So they sent me all these links, and one of the most interesting is a couple people said, there's already a list like that. It's called youshouldhaveseenthis.com.
Oh, gosh.
And it's 100. You know, they're all there. The Star Wars kid, the dancing baby, the exploding whale. You know, every single classic YouTube video is there in a list for you to click through one at a time and watch them to get your WQ, your web quotient, up to speed. So my kids and I have been doing that for the last few days. We've been working our way through this list. And
well, it's kind of like
there's no freaking hope for America. I'm sorry. Well, this is what passes for culture, man.
It's a bit like it's like the AFI 100, except you can do it a lot faster.
That's right.
It's for our ADZ minds. Alex, do you have a favorite YouTube viral video of all time?
My favorite. You know, I responded to David's tweet, and
tweet.
I sent him a
tweet. Hello, dude.
Twitter.
Loser.
Yeah, exactly. I just blew it. I don't usually say that. I just say I'm twittering. So it's I don't remember what my favorite would be, but I like some of the classic ones. I mean, the Urban Ninja one I thought was cool. The kid.
You guys have seen the Ninja Cat, haven't you?
I have not seen the Ninja Cat.
That's a brilliant piece of pixels, man. It's go to YouTube and look up the Ninja Cat. It's screamingly funny.
I would have to say pretty much any good cat video would be right at the top. I just love cat videos. They're just, you know, I think that's what YouTube was made for silly cat videos. And people know that. A lot of Twim listeners just send me, they're like, I know you like silly cat videos. Here's the great one. Like that cat on the Roomba vacuum from Finland. Wasn't that a great video? Well, Colleen knows what I'm talking about.
The person who is the master of YouTube, as far as I'm concerned, that I know, is Justine. You know, Justine Ezerich.
Justine.
It's not just that you see her videos, because her videos, from my point of view, sometimes are just, I don't know what she's trying to do there, but she gets a lot of views. And she, when you talk to her, she was in our office shooting on Friday all day, and she totally, she totally understands what she's doing. Like every
she
video
is the internet.
But I mean, there's a very clear reason that she shoots each piece, and she shot three shows. You know, while we were shooting, it was like, you know, she's very prolific, and it's amazing how well she can wield a flip camera. That's all I have to say.
She's so talented. I mean, yeah. she's the whole package. She is beautiful. So. She is smart, and she can do anything. She can kick anyone's butt on a Mac editing. I've been instructed by listeners to let David and Alex geek out a little bit. On about technology, so. People know when I said you were going to be on the show, Dave. You're like, make sure to spend a little bit of time letting David and Alex go into the rat hole about new technology and gadgets. And since that's you guys are much much better at that than I am, I guess I'll open it up with David. What are the coolest new gadgets technologies that you've seen lately? What do you love? And then I'm going to let you respond, Alex, because this is your area and you know it better than me.
You know, honestly, what interests me always more than the technology is the interaction with culture. Just like this story with the Rick rolling and people feeling so irate that I didn't know what it was. You know, I mean, if you haven't been Rick rolled, how exactly would you ever have heard the term? So it's not totally my fault. But anyway, so the coolest thing that I've seen lately is what I wrote about in my column a couple days ago. It's the MiFi. It's the size of a credit card. Battery-powered, rechargeable, portable, personal Wi-Fi hotspot. So wherever you are, on the beach, in a taxi, in the woods, you are online. Just like one of those USB cellular modems, yes, like those, except that it's Wi-Fi. So what that means is, A, you don't have to plug something into your laptop that can get snapped off by a passing beverage cart. B, five of you can be online at the same time, all using it. C, you just leave it in your purse or your computer bag. You open the laptop, boom, you are online at you know the speed of that connection. So I thought it was just amazing, and nothing really like it had ever been done before. There have been cellular Wi-Fi routers that plug into the wall, but that let five people get online at once. But how is that going to help you when you're, you know, on the beach? So anyway,
because you should always be using your computer on the beach.
Absolutely.
Of course. You wanted us to go down the rat hole.
I have to say that it's fantastic. I actually read the article and it was floating around a little bit before, and I saw it. And the thing is that we commonly, what we do is someone has a Jeep, no matter what country I'm in. Usually I think about it more when I'm in another country, but I was in the UK, we were shooting there, and you know, it's $20 or $25 a day at the hotel to have a Wi-Fi connection or wow. to have a Ethernet connection. But there were two of us, you know, in the hotel room, you know, the other guy that was shooting with me. And so...
And it's usually a separate price, too, per computer.
No, it is per computer.
What I did is
what any geek would do is I plugged into my computer and then on my Mac, I just create a network and boom, now both of us. And the added benefit of that was, of course, that I could use my iPhone, the Skype on my iPhone to call my wife for free. So I'm calling from the UK at a quality level that is much higher than the telephone for free. And, it's expensive. Anyone who goes overseas with an iPhone knows that it can be very painful if you're not careful. And so, and that's one of the things I think is really interesting about this technology is the idea of not only doing that, but being able to use Skype and from your phone, no matter where you're at. Now, that doesn't matter that much for... But there's a lot of things within the iPhone, for instance, that are only currently accessible when you're hooked to Wi-Fi. So being able to bypass that is kind of interesting.
But what I found most interesting was the backlash, which was immediate and violent. It reminded me exactly of what happened before the iPhone was out. I mean, the bloggers were like, it sucks. It's got no keyboard. You can't change the battery. It sucks. And it's like, dude, you've never tried it. You have no idea if it sucks. And the same thing with the MiFi, people kept coming up with, I mean, I was deluged by email by people telling me why it was lame. You know, I can do the same thing with my cellular modem. Well, no, you can't. You can't get five people online unless you have your laptop and know how to turn on internet sharing. And even then, once your laptop battery's dead, the kids in the backseat with their iPod touches can't get online. Well, I jailbroke my iPhone and hacked it so I can get my laptop online.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know, but it's not a Wi-Fi hotspot, and jailbreaking is complicated, and it eats up the battery like crazy. Well, I have, this software on my Nokia E51 that's not sold in the United States, and I was like, shut up. That's not mainstream solutions. Those are like for nerds like you.
The thing with, for me is always Apple, this is like an Apple device where it's 90 of 90, which is 90% of the people. What will 90% of the people want 90% of the time? You know, to me, that's what an Apple product is it's 90-90, and it's not the 10-10. You know, what 10% of people want 10% of the time, which is exactly, I think, what you're, outlining. What's the price point on the MiFi?
You mean what's the price?
Price. What is the price? Sorry.
Are you paid by the word or some price?
I'm just used to saying that word. I don't know. What's the price?
It's $100 and you'll love the form factor.
Sorry.
It's our jargon world. Sorry. Okay, so David, how much time in your day is spent dealing with backlash? Because I'm getting the sense with the Rick rolling and the MiFi and the email.
Lately, it's been like 100.
Right. That's kind of what you're doing day in and day out. Well, and of course, not that Alex needs my defense, but David, you talk to consumers. You have to say, do you have to use words like price? We can say price point.
I literally, as you can tell, I'm a little sensitive to this buzzword thing. I mean, I really don't understand why is there jargon price point when it means the same as the existing English word price? That's the part
you
get.
You know, one of my editors at a trade magazine used to give me, he forbid me from using monetization. He goes, there's another way to say it. How to make money. You say how to make money. Companies are trying to figure out how to make money with web video, not how to monetize it. I thought, that's kind of a good point.
So now David, what's your favorite video camera out there now?
My favorite video camera?
Yeah, for consumer.
The Flip is just eating up the market. They have, over a third of the camcorder market by themselves for this little plastic thing with no zoom and no menus. Pretty amazing. And I have to say, even I, the uber gadget geek of all time, wind up carrying that thing in my camera bag because, you know what, there's one button. You don't have to check for batteries, don't have to check for tape, don't have to see if the knob is in playback or record. It just, there's one button and it's recording. And it has the added benefit that, when my four-year-old is doing something cute, I'm not, you know, it's not like this when I'm recording him, which would make him stop. I literally hold it at chest level like this. He doesn't even know he's on camera. So as a result, it's a lot less threatening to the subject.
Just, I was just curious. We have a flip. My wife has a flip, and she loves it. And because it fits in the diaper bag, and she doesn't have to know anything about it. And, you know, she, the kids, you know, with
the flip
me,
is hers. That's what she uses for the
She uses the flip. Yeah. She loves it. Flip HD. And she loves it. Yeah. So it's that's definitely I have lots of.
You have every type of camera.
Well, they just show
camera.
Up in the mail. So I review
okay,
them.
I'll tell you what I'm waiting for, though. I am in the market for a camcorder because I'm sadly convinced that tape is dead. They're not doing any more research and development. The models are coming out more and more infrequently. The public has spoken. They've said they don't want tape. They don't want to rewind and stuff. So everything's hard drive or memory card or whatever. But not a single one, to my knowledge, can match the video quality of tape. You know, mini DV is 25 megabits per second, and the maximum of AVCHD or whatever it is 19 megabits per second.
Actually,
so it's just compressed more. It will never look as good. So the day they come out with a tapeless camcorder whose quality is as good as tape, I will buy one.
You know, I don't know if I agree. Now, the maximum, the theoretical maximum that is being utilized by Canon is 24 megabits a second. And that is the new Canon Santa, and I think one other manufacturer using it. And I've been shooting with the HG21, I just did a review for it for Macworld.com, and it was, and I thought it was as good as what I was getting on my HDV tapes. Now, I thought that some of that has to do with the sensor. So the compression is, I'm not sure whether, you know, I didn't feel like the compression was any worse than what I see on HDV.
I have heard this, in fact, and I, in fact, have asked Canon PR if I could see one to review. So thinking that one might be close.
The one that I'm really excited about is actually, the one that I'm most excited about is the HFS-100 or the HFS-10. Both are Canon. The thing for me is that, you know, my wife likes the flip and I like all the dials. So I like the fact that I can set it to manual. I have peaking in the HFS 10 and HFS 100. And I put in requests to review them as well. But I'm excited about the idea that I have total manual control. I have the ability to, as I said, have peaking, which is something we're used to in pro cameras. We're not used to seeing in peaking means that when it's sharp, the edges of whatever sharp turns red or blue or whatever. So you know you're sharp really, really fast on a little screen. And then you also have Z-Brain, which doesn't usually happen in little cameras oftentimes. And then it also does 24p or 30p. It does 24 megabits per second, which is going to be a nice high quality. It seems like the whole package. And as people have found when I review stuff for Macworld.com, I'm pretty rough about it. So not many people have done very well so far. But I haven't seen it yet. So I'm excited about taking a look at that one because I think that those cameras both look... I mean, the Canon for camcorders, Canon cameras for us have been internally in our office. We have lots of cameras floating around, everything from, you know, $250,000 cameras to these little handhelds. And they seem to be the ones that we, at that low end, that we like the most. The Sonys are kind of in the mid end and the high end, and the Red is somewhere in between. But I'm really excited to see, you know, where we go, you know, these cameras. I mean, the chips now, the Canon and the new Sony are nearing a half inch chip, which is, when it comes to low light performance, you get, you know, it really changes. And we saw it when we did tests against, our test charts. You really see a much higher quality image, coming out of the camera, with these much larger chips. And so hopefully we'll see more.
All right, so there you go. So I'm going to wrap things up in just a few minutes, but I have two topics that I want to make sure we get to before we close the show. One is that last week 60 Frames shut down, and that 60 Frames was a web studio, and it had actually sold webisodes to the WB.com, to Crackle, to FunnyOrDie.com, and even a TV pilot to HBO. This is according to a Hollywood Reporter story. This company had about, I think, $3.5 million in venture funding. It was led by Brent Weinstein, a former UTA agent. And, of course, this follows Mania TV, closing down earlier this year. I think there are a lot of these other sort of digital studios that obviously are having trouble. So I guess the bigger question is, I mean, remaining players include folks like Generate, Next New Networks, Deca, and so on. Who will be left standing, and what does this mean for independence? Okay, we'll start with you, Alex, and then David.
Well, I mean, I just came back from NAB, and a lot of the situation is that we there was a lot of people who were actually pretty excited. There's less big screens that are available, but a lot more screens that are available for production. And so if you are a company that is anywhere near the traditional model of production, which we're not, there's a lot of stress that's going on because you have a lot of overhead, you have a lot of expensive equipment, you have a lot of stuff that you have to maintain, and salaries and a lot of other things. Those companies are going to have a hard time. They're going to continue to have a hard time. We're going to see more of them, you know, hitting the ground as we go through it. I think companies that find cheaper, faster, better ways of getting this stuff done are the ones that are going to be that keep themselves a little bit more flexible. Are going to be the ones that tend to do better. And that just tends to be in any kind of crunch. That tends to be what you see. Either the really big guys oftentimes can weather a storm, and the little guys can find a place to hide. it's the guys in between.
And some of these digital studios, frankly, have maybe been a little too much middle of the road. I'm not sure of the specifics in terms of how many employees 60 Frames had, but $3.5 million is not a lot of funding for the type of shows that 60 Frames was doing. And then you take a Mania TV, which already closed down. That was a company that had $26 million in funding, but at one point had, I believe, almost 70 employees. I mean, I don't think there's a single web studio that should have 70 employees. I mean, I think maybe 10 at the max. I mean, what do you have at Pixelcore? Are you allowed to say how many employees you have?
Yes, I'm allowed to say how many employees I have. It is my company. We have 12. We have 12 employees. But not all of them are in production. So there's people who are doing, you know, other support stuff. You know,
right.
But we have there's about 5 people that are full time just doing production work, and we'll probably expand that, but we probably won't go over about 15.
But of course, you're not a venture backed company, and you expanded as you won business, not before.
We expand very slowly, actually.
Yeah.
So we generally our guys are overwhelmed before we add another person. You know, and then it slows
drive
down.
Them to the ground, well, and make them suffer.
We're pretty good at managing that, but we started adding. We realized the guys were working too hard, and we started adding one person a month until they stopped
complaining.
Yeah, exactly. So they started saying, "Oh, this is really working." And so that allows us to have a very, very tight organizational structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now we freelance out to as many as 15 or 20 people at a time. So there's a lot of work in small pieces that are going out all over the world, literally. To us, that's the easiest way for us to manage
right.
all
scale
the
up,
all the
scale
peaks
down.
Are all being handled by freelancers. And then when we see a trend that we're constantly getting this much work is when we start adding headcount.
So David, what's your take on digital studios like the aforementioned, Generate, Next New Networks, Take 180, so on and so forth? I mean, My Damn Channel, folks that are kind of betting that there is a big enough opportunity for them to produce shows for the web, and in some cases for, you know, the sexier web portals, and maybe even for TV networks.
Well, I think Alex's analysis was excellent. This is a time of great change and, you know, great opportunity, although a bummer for everybody who's going out of business, both in the web studio category and Main Street. I mean, everywhere. You should see our town in Connecticut. The Main Street is like it's a total ghost town, like out of business, out of business, out of business. So it's tough times. And the other thing, the only insight I have to bring to bear to this subject is that we geeks tend to get self-obsessed and think that the world is like us. But the world is not like us. The huge majority of the world's people still watch television on a television and still watch read newspapers on a newspaper. You know, we're not all digital yet. Yes, on the East Coast and the West Coast, we're all hip and we're all, you know, post-TV, post-newspaper. But most of the world isn't. And most of the world has not heard of Rickrolling and doesn't know what Twitter is and so on. So we have to keep that in mind, too. You might think that the future is little short web vignettes made by these little companies, but, you know, that's actually still fringe.
Well, and I think that's the exciting part. I think the what part of what makes it exciting is that that this stuff hasn't expanded. You know, that to me that means that there's a lot more market to take advantage of. So it's a lot of there's a lot of growth opportunity, a lot of open fields. We tend to think that it's. I always find it funny when people in my industry get really protective about their little space and what they know, and they figured out how to do something special. And we do training about how we do what we do because you know we're not worried about it. I mean, there's so much. There's so much
there's
out
enough
there right
out
now.
There. Yeah. Now I have what I hope will be a fun question for you, David. And this is from Arthur Greenwald, who is a writer with TV Newsday and a TV producer. And he says, here's a question for Pogue, who, as you may know, started out as an orchestra conductor for Broadway shows. If they were making a musical about the giants of technology and media, who would you cast in the leads?
You know what? The truth is nobody knows what the giants of technology look or act like beyond Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and that one's been done.
Exactly.
I mean, if I say, oh, we got Matt Damon to play Sergey Brin, everyone would be like, what?
Colleen here at Leo's Place thinks that's a perfect solution. Matt Damon as Sergey Brin. All right. We like, see, you're speaking to the right audience. Feel free. The rest of the world doesn't care, but we care. Wait,
but
who's Larry Page?
I love the idea of a Broadway musical about technology. I'm on it.
Colleen says Larry Page should be Ben Affleck. And now this is just totally a self-serving question because I'm a huge Broadway fan myself. But what's the favorite Broadway musical you've ever conducted?
The favorite one.
Your favorite
would be
one.
Would be the only one.
Well, that's easy.
I was an assistant. I was an arranger. I was a pianist and a bunch of them, but the only one I actually conducted on Broadway was called Welcome to the Club. It was a Cy Coleman flop. We worked on it for 3 years in bigger and bigger and bigger theaters all the way to Broadway, and it ran for 6 nights.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, what's the one that if you could conduct any Broadway show, what would it be?
Oh, man. I'd pay to conduct Avenue Q. My stomach hurts. Hurt from laughing after that show, and the music is great and the lyrics are inspired.
That's a great answer. I love it. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being on, David. Where can people find you?
So it's 24 Sycamore Drive. Is this necessary? DavidPogue.com or Pogue at nytimes.com is my email.
Terrific. And Alex, where can people find you?
They can find me Where can they find me? They can find me on the Twitters.
Oh.
Alex Lindsay,
tweeting.
All one word. I'm tweeting.
He's tweeting on the Twitters.
And sometimes Rick Rolling.
Exactly.
When I feel like it.
And you can find me at daisywhitney.com where you can find links to the work that I'm doing and on Twitter at Daisy Whitney. So there you go. We are over and out.